coming to our final talk for today here. This is Connor Quinn, and he's going to be talking about taking down the barriers, accessibility by de-technicalization and minimalist presentation. So please welcome Connor Quinn.
Hello, and thank you for showing up at the end of the afternoon. All right, in language revitalization, the first question we ask is, who are we leaving out? Immersion works, it works really well, but it leaves out anyone who can't be there for the dozens of hours a week it takes to work, which is basically everybody except school children. We can't show up for that. Now that technical grammar explicit teaching approach works, but only if you're a few linguistic nerds like you and at least some of the audience here. It doesn't work very well for almost everybody else, and it often makes people feel less able to learn and use the language than they actually are. Now, writing can help. It makes the language visible, which can reclaim territory for the language from signposts to social media, and it can give the language the respect that is standardly, but completely unfairly, only given to languages with a written form. But it leaves out the many all the speakers that were never schooled in it, this writing, who may never be schooled in it, and who, like many first-time learners, may have trouble with these, quote, practical alphabets, ones that require them to forget the English use of familiar letters and re-understand them in brand new ways. Worst of all, though, schools' insistence on putting writing front and center makes many speakers hang back, being directly or indirectly told that their expertise as speakers is still not enough. So in designing a language program, we ask, and we keep on asking, who are we leaving out? And based on those answers, we design and redesign, aiming to leave nobody out. Because language is for including people. It can be used to exclude, but it always starts out as a way for you and me to talk to each other, to bring our thoughts together. But language reclamation is so easily ghettoized, a group of dedicated people over there in the corner saving the language while everyone else does something else. Speakers versus non-speakers can so easily become haves versus have-nots, which makes the most inclusive option be to go back to English. And again, English I'm using as a stand-in for any other language that's coming along and stomping on the local one. And that's so often what happens, because we want to include everybody in the conversation. So how do we keep speaking the language without leaving anyone out? Language should be communicable. It should be difficult to not share. It should be nothing but inclusive and inviting, where you can share a basic useful lesson with an interested friend across a single conversation so that they never have to set foot in the classroom. And then the language can spread back out that way. But so much of our experience, even in teaching and learning, is not that. The language is framed as difficult and demanding, requiring years of dedication, something most of us don't really have the time and energy for. So how do we change that? How do we make it inclusive again, inviting people in rather than scaring them away? Well, we invite people in by not making a barrier out of technical grammar, by not making a barrier out of writing, by not making a barrier out of very demanding approaches to learning the language. So we de-technicalize. We stop making linguistese a required part of learning the language. We re-oralize. We focus on speech and leave writing at the margins of what we teach. We minimize. We offer lessons that are brief, absorbable in a matter of minutes, but teach patterns in them, patterns carefully chosen to be both immediately useful and provide a really good framework for picking up more. Above all, as academics, we invite people in by not asking them to simply become us. A common excuse for teaching with technical terms, like in my corner of the field, animate versus inanimate, conjunct, independent, indicative, all that sort of stuff, and you can imagine stuff from the languages you work with, is that this will help learners in the long run. It'll open the doors for them to read the linguistic literature, use the dictionary and grammar charts, and help them present their own analyses at conferences like these and others. And this is true. But I believe the main reason is that it's easier for us linguists. We think of the language in linguistese, and so it's easiest for us to ask people to wade through our linguistese just to get to their language. which gives them only two choices. Do immersion, with no explanation, or learn it this academic way that's easy for us. If neither one of those fits your life, then you're on your own to figure out the language for yourself. And this isn't on purpose. Everybody naturally explains things the way they learn to understand them. And it's a real challenge to rethink everything the way we learn by, say, these technical terms, trying to work out equally accurate, but not oversimplifying, dumbing it down, but more widely accessible ways to talk about them. But it can be done, and it should be done. To do otherwise is just to keep on privileging academic priorities over the needs of everyday learners. Now don't get me wrong, I think most linguistically informed teaching efforts are very much trying to keep it non-technical. But I still find that most people trying to get their language back are either getting no explanations at all, or they're struggling through all this technical jargon, or even sort of the insidious remains of technical jargon in what has been simplified, they say, or de-technicalized, but not still not effectively enough. And this is really getting in their way, and in the speaker's way. And pretty much all the published learning materials that I've seen in the languages that I work with have this problem. So it's a very, very, very real problem. It plays a big part in how everyone says they want to learn the language, but then no one shows up to the class, or they all give up after the first day or so. We need to give them something that they can really connect with. So, how do we do this? Well, I've been lucky enough to work for the last 20-odd years with heritage learners of several Algonquin languages, primarily Penobscot, Passamaquoddy, Maliseet, and Mi'kmaq. And I've seen how English-based learners struggle with Algonquin language patterns. And here I will talk not about three, but just two of them, which are famously difficult for learners. The so-called animate versus inanimate noun classes, and complex verbs, very complex verbs, and how they richly mark participants in other parts of events. I should take that back. They're actually not that complex. Depends on how you look at it. So I'll try to show that any of these kinds of language patterns are very easily learnable when we do two things. One, we reframe the traditional academic technical understandings utterly strictly in everyday terms, utterly strictly. And we keep new material per lesson at an equally strict minimum. Again, anything less than this leaves people out. Technical terms overwhelm beginners and exclude untrained native speakers from direct participation. So we show how to avoid all technical terms by looking closely at the meaning of a given language pattern and then creatively identifying and teaching from real conversations that hinge on and or around that meaning, the meaning that that, say, grammar pattern provides, meaningful contribution to actual communication. Similarly, traditional non-minimalist presentation is overwhelming. You show a whole grammar chart to people and you lose half the class and everyone else comes home telling friends and family how complicated and unlearnable their language is. And busy learners have to set aside big chunks of time to pick up even one core idea. In contrast, we stay rigorously on a less is more strategy. For example, we start just with me versus you forms, which are the minimal for grasping the pattern, yet already enough to use successfully in a simple face-to-face conversation between me and you. Now, for a concrete example of how to simplify, consider the Algonquin noun classes traditionally called animate and inanimate. These cause massive problems for English-based learners because many, quote, animate things are not alive, and some inanimate things are. The terminology is externally imposed, and it does not match anything speakers actually report about their worldview. That's important. Even as it baffles heritage learners. So here are some ways to deal with these problems. As teachers, we can just stop calling them that. There's no good reason to when every Algonquin language has inanimate words for live, grow, and die. That's fine to keep in the technical literature, but it's not fine to confuse and intimidate rank beginners. We can tell them that animate versus inanimate means something different when applied to Algonquin, but that's worse than no label at all. It tangles them up in some special sense of animate versus inanimate that no speaker has ever suggested, and just tells them that the language has unreachably exotic rethinkings of English ideas, some mystery that they've already missed out on by not being born into it. That drives away learners and denies them the chance that the Algonquin categories might just be equally straightforward in their own way and learnable. And instead, another thing we can do is just name them within the language. So in Penobscot, we can call these two categories na words versus ni words after the matching word, corresponding word for that for each of those categories. And a few languages don't match in this exact way. So in Mi'kmaq, for example, it's possible to use instead the matching word for one, nokte ajit versus nokte. And as verbs also match for category, we can also name those categories using short matching verbs, one for each group. And this can also be funny if your matching sort of test verb is silly with the word at hand. So your test verb is broken, you have broken shoe and broken car and broken apple. Because language work should never miss a chance to have people laugh. So this also solves another problem. On this kind of separating approach, learners have to remember which group the noun belongs to and then which verb endings and plurals match that. And this is not natural. And widely unlearnable. But if you learn a word for the first time, already with its matching word, though, and we start off not with a series of rules to follow, but a manageable handful of real use models, off of which we can build up a more instinct-based sense of what just sounds right. Finally, all research seems to show that this first group, including people and animals and lots of other things, is in some sense the special one, while the other group just covers everything else. So all we need is a grip on this first group. And here's the trick. We don't try to find one super rule that explains them all. Instead, we look for little families of first group words. This helps because those families aren't entirely the same across all Algonquin languages, or even within the same community. Trees and shoes and stones change membership from language to language. There's no one single rule. There's no one right answer. So what does work is noticing the families as they come up, bottom up, of themselves. When shoes are in this group, so are boots and moccasins and so on. Other common families are fluid containers like cups, or thorns, needles, and spikes, or soft-skinned, substantially fleshy fruit like raspberries and plums. But basically, you have to work those families out for particular language, for each particular Algonquin language, particular community, or even particular speaker. But from there, they live. New words join the old families so that Passamaquoddy Maliseet speakers readily tell us that for them, cup-like thermoses and needle-like syringes and plum-like dates all do follow that first group pattern. So we learners no longer have to memorize endless individual mysteries word by word. We can ground each of these words in families, and then they're teachable. We can do as Marianne Metallic does and collect up pictures of all these unexpected members of the people and animals group and put those families together. So we see visually pictures of all the soft fleshy fruits together, all the footwear together, all the needles and spikes together, so that we encourage learners not to think of this as something separate and arbitrary about each word alone, but instead something that it's part of, a relationship that it enters into, a bigger picture that it belongs to. And a final key point, this isn't just for learners. Every time teachers and learners talk about animate, inanimate, transitive, transitive, inanimate, et cetera, all our jargon, in front of native speakers not trained in those terms, this quietly excludes them and unintentionally devalues their expertise. Whereas with the native words for that approach, or this families-based approach, and especially this small matching phrases, small matching verbs approach, are all very directly accessible for native speakers and help bring all the traditions of understanding Algonquin languages together. So that's one example of taking a tricky, typically over-technicalized phenomenon and teasing it out into a presentation that's readily accessible to learners and speakers alike. Now we can do the same for famously complex verbs, showing how they richly mark parts and participants of events. Learners are intimidated by the length of Algonquin words, but even the biggest polysynthetic dinosaur word comes out of a series of very simple buildups. Our goal for beginners is to show just this basic buildup, and then later the dinosaur words are just more of the same. Minimalism is what matters here. We don't show everything that the words can do, just the simplest models of the core pattern from which learners can build up. And here we can detechnicalize a big stack of linguistic mishigas just by saying that Algonquin words, loosely speaking, have an inner layer, that's the vocabulary itself, and a thin outer layer of changes that show its relations, relations to other words and to the conversation. Looking at that inner layer, we demystify those dinosaur words by showing they all come from a very simple pattern. The language has a rich vocabulary of suffixes, and most words are something, really anything, plus a meaningful suffix. And this is fun. This is fun for learners and speakers alike to see that there's no limit to how many new words you can make. And again, simplicity is important at first, so tidy common patterns are good places to start. One fun one is where the suffix names different kinds of motion, like dance, jump, run, and is tacked onto something telling the direction of that motion. So you can say crazy fun things like dance into the house, swim down the hill, and so on. Another is where the suffix names different kinds of action, especially means of action, and is tacked onto something telling the result of that action. So you get single words that mean bite it open, cut it open, hit it up, pick it up and hit it so that it opens, stomp it open, and so forth. Whichever way, the important thing is for learners and speakers to get to play with the patterns, having fun and enjoying what the language lets them say. It turns out, in fact, that suffixes are strictly limited to only certain kinds of meaning like these, and knowing that can help a learner even make really good guesses about the meaning of an entirely new suffix if they already know the part of the word and the context. As it stands, however, suffix vocabulary tends to be the least and last taught because the beginning parts of words are the more obvious ones, especially as you scan through a dictionary, but it's the suffixes that drive the richness of word building. And with that, you unleash not only the ability of the learner to recognize and remember dinosaur words more easily, but also start returning to them one of the greatest gifts of the language, the humor, the poetry, and the conceptual richness of these words, and the chance to contribute their own. Now, for the outer layer of words, where they change to reflect different relations, this is where minimalism really comes in teaching. Here we're really looking at the busy, only has 5 minutes a day learner. So we adopt a simple 7-point approach, 7 brief points that set up even the 5-minute-a-day learner with the essentials of the system. This is the product of 2 main design principles, which I think are extensible to any language. Principle A, thorough and intensive analysis of the system as a whole to pick out not just what is a prerequisite or foundation to what, but crucially, the absolute minimal set of information that's needed at each step. For most Algonquin languages, we discover that we can, for example, leverage 2 key facts, that the marking for my noun and your noun happens to be the same as the marking for I verb and you verb. That's one. The other one, the command form of give, like give me it or give her it, provides the simplest door into the entire verbal matching system. So those are the kind of things we'd find in this language for this purpose. Second principle, being relentless in whittling it back, aiming to teach as little as possible at first, but also that which gives the most communicative bang for your buck. As you'll see, the approach is usable for naturalistic immersion, that is, like structured learning with no explicit explanation, and also, of course, actually pretty easy explicit instruction. And so what follows might sound familiar, but a key difference is that we are not teaching anything but these exact phrases given below. We never extend out into that full grammar chart, the intimidating one, until everyone has these few phrases down solid. So for example, for lesson one, we start teaching by teaching how to ask, who is that and what is that? And answer not only with sort of simple identifications, but also, that is my mother, that is your mother. So besides its everyday usefulness, especially for talking about family and kin, this introduces in this language, the na versus ni words, those two classes, and also how to relate me and you to a thing or a person. So next up is, I'm called blah, 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 my name is, sort of thing. I'm called blah, 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 you are called blah, blah, blah. And we point out to learners that all we're doing is leveraging the pattern from my thing and your thing that they already know. So from me or you relating to a thing or person, just to me or you relating to an event. Then we go on to learning just two more phrases. That's what I'm called and that's what you're called. This introduces the very different pattern of endings for me and for you, because Algonquin systems for this are generally wildly different for independent clauses versus dependent ones. So, and this is so that learners master those endings, just those two endings, one for me and one for you, and know not simply to use that first set of endings, the ones they learned in the previous lesson, as English would have them do, using that first set of endings for me, and using that first set of endings for me and for you for everything. So this gets them set up to avoid some long-term English-based habits that are going to cost them a lot in the long run. So from here, we use these phrases. We take a bit of a turn. We use the phrases just give me it, like give me the apple, and give her it, give her the apple, that kind of thing, to introduce how words match the main target of the action. Give me, give her, just that, two phrases. And then in the next lesson, we're already on to another lesson. The pattern of the request, give me it, leverages directly onto the pattern of the statement, the corresponding statement, just the statement, you give me it. And then to flip it, we can simply change one part to get, I give you it. So with these two new phrases, combined with the last two, so that's totally, give me it, give him or her it, and then the statement, you give me it, based on the previous one, and ultimately, you give her it, is enough. With these two phrases, learners have already mastered the basics behind the most complex matching patterns there is, that is for the three participants in a give event, like I give you it. And then the next lesson is simply going through that with that's what you give me and that's what I give you, with those dependent clause forms for the same reason as we did them after we learned how to say I am called X and so forth. Finally, and this is the last lesson in the series, we bring in one or two of the words that manage the conversation, the little particles that show shift of topic, a focus on something, a note that the information is secondhand, etc. Exactly which get covered first is less important than just making sure that one or two of them are, so that these small words, these small particles, don't fall by the wayside, and their absolute centrality to conversation in these languages is clear from the get-go. So a lot is left out here, which is a good thing. All we've done is get a learner able to identify people and things and basic relations to events, but only in two ways, me and you. This is enough to have a simple face-to-face conversation between me and you, talking about me and you, which is the first thing we want to be able to do. And it avoids, for the moment, the complications brought in by talking about she, he, it, and they, which involve an external Algonquin-specific contrast known as obviation. Ask me about it if you like. So what they have learned here is a specific set of landmarks. Having done the work, we find that almost every other pattern fits into the spaces in between these landmarks. It just builds off of the simple foundation of these few. So such that if, in the end, the learners master just the concepts behind the above, what I've just mentioned, this above, this handful of phrases, only about 18, in fact, and use them as models for those concepts, then they're set up for everything else. So the idea here is you get a very good knowledge of a small number of things, rather than lots of things you only thinly understand. So this is no magic promise of instant Algonquin grammar in 7 days, but it comes close. And more importantly, it gives people the big picture without a big workload, just the bare minimum it takes to get talking right away about me versus you. It sets people up so that early on they can see where they're going, so that from here on, almost anything new can be grounded on something they already know. And at the same time, it demands about as little time as possible and can be reviewed and refreshed just as easily and shared with a friend over a cup of coffee. It can all be done orally, doesn't require anybody writing things down, just that quick. So learners have both core patterns for immediate everyday use and exactly the foundation and framework that they need to easily pick up the remaining patterns. So in conclusion, it's our responsibility as linguists and teachers and so on to make language learning not require a school or a teacher. We have to make it possible for one adult learner to teach another one over lunch or sitting on a boat while fishing. We can do this when we keep the insights of linguistic analysis, but return the way we talk about them rigorously back to the natural conversational uses that they help explain. We can do this when we avoid lists and charts and ask people to learn a basic concept or pattern using the least amount of it, which is often just you and me. And this kind of minimalism can also be extended to other things like vocabulary. Marianne Metallic, for example, first introduces just a few people and thing vocabulary grounded in pictures, and then uses those like about 8 to 18 words and uses them as a simple anchor for saying a wide range of sentences. We are also, we're also experimenting with a body-centered approach to prioritizing core vocabulary, especially for verbs. All of this to reduce the amount of vocabulary we're asking beginners to learn, even as that vocabulary allows them to express the most that they possibly can. So, thorough detechnicalization, thoroughgoing, genuine, deep detechnicalization, and less is more presentation help to create engaging, accessible materials for learners and native speakers alike. These radically change how much beginners get out for what they're asked to put in, which can decide whether they join the speech community and whether they stay. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Connor. We've got about 8 minutes for questions, so if anyone has any questions, please feel free.
It's hard to see out there. Hunting, yeah?
There's a sort of a follow-up to your minimal strategy about using conversational context.
Mm-hmm.
So, wouldn't especially with Algonquin languages, one additional value to that is that if I say something about myself using the meaning context,
mm-hmm.
then actually saying something about you,
mm-hmm.
I don't have to do much to do that.
That's exactly the point of, that's why we started with me, because you don't have to play any other games, but it at least gets people in the idea that, oh, when we speak this language, we just change that part of the word to signal these differences. So for example, we could be teaching people very on the original set of, free pronouns in the Algonquin languages. However, as soon as you give English speakers free pronouns, they immediately start using them as separate words in a sentence. Whereas if you've just never introduced people to that yet, they have no way to make that English-based mistake. And instead, you just are teaching people two words that they move back and forth, me and gi, like you're saying. And you don't have to lecture them about you know, conjugate your verbs, because that's the only thing they know how to do. Yeah?
So you avoid transitive animate structures?
No. Actually, one of the key things is, as you said, when we laid it out, the thing we do immediately right after that is teach give me that and give her that. We don't avoid any grammatical point of Algonquin in the wrong one. What we do is we pick out the main ones, because it turns out one of the things about Algonquin verbs is the most complex form is the transitive animate object, basically just a ditransitive verb, and that's the one we teach first. We flip it. There are much sort of putatively simpler versions, simpler conjugation patterns and so forth, but actually if you start with the most complex one and find a simple way to teach that, every other grammatical pattern of that sort in the language is actually just a subset of that. So speakers, when encountering the other ones, will basically already know everything and then some of what they need for that one. So we flip it on its head.
So being a non-linguist, all that was Greek, I suppose.
Oh yeah, well yeah, which is why normally I don't, you know, the goal of this is not to talk about it that way.
So I guess how would you extend your idea to other languages? What would you do if you were like walking into?
Well, give me an example of a language, just off the, just to start.
Say Blackfoot.
Blackfoot?
Yeah.
What you would do is you, the point of this is basically to get the benefit of the linguistic analysis without all the costs. So you would probably want some yourself, or if you're not a linguist yourself, to go through a series of, like, say, the best example would be everyday speech, like if you everyday speech of Blackfoot, and look linguistically at what those structures are yourself, and then say what is most foundational, like what does every conversation at least require, and what is more peripheral? It's genuinely part of the language, but it doesn't show up in the language as much as this, and that's still not enough. You have to sort of say what's the most common grammatical stuff, and then you have to look at the most common grammatical stuff and dig down and say which bits of grammatical stuff are built off of which bits of grammatical stuff, right? So that you know that sort of everyone knows that kind of grammatical progression, right? And that's still not enough. You have to dig down deeper and say which bits are built up, you know, now that I know which bits are foundational to which other bits, what is the smallest number of examples of that, say, most bottom foundational grounding bit of grammar that could essentially get a person noticing it and aware of it? So for example, if a major difference is if your language, for example, the verb changes, has at least 8 different forms for every, you know, one for each possible pronoun or verb, don't teach that. What you do is you teach just me and you, and that gets people able to get the principle of that our language does it this way by putting, you know, a ni on the front or a gi on the front for me and for you. And then you just work with that, and you kind of work that into the ground. Just do that with, you know, one or two verbs, or just one verb at first that people can use in regular conversation, like I'm called this, you're called that, or I'm happy, you're hungry, and so forth. And basically, when people are starting to get tired of doing that, is when they'll ask of themselves, hey, how do you say he or she, right? Which is a lot better than the usual way, where you show people the giant scary chart of how we conjugate our verbs, and everybody kind of shuts down. Instead, you're keeping it to the bare minimum. So it's a substantial process, like genuinely and effectively figuring out what is an accessible and not overwhelming way to teach a language is not as simple as just sort of saying, well, we know how the language works, we're just gonna not use grammatical terminology, right? And just sort of throw things at people in that way. And like I said, you kind of have to go through this at least 3-stage process of sort of figuring out what is most prioritized, then what are the relationships between those most prioritized things, like most commonly used grammatical patterns in language. And as again, you can see I'm mostly talking about, and then, oh, sorry, I'll finish that off. What are the relations between them, and then what's the simplest, literally kind of the simplest way to make that obvious what's going on, rather than the full pattern of what that one grammatical point can possibly do. Just the simplest instance, the simplest example of it. That is at least enough for people to go. And again, you want to pick an example that's not just simple, but useful, right? That we're giving me and ki, because you and me, now I can talk with you in our language about this. I could give you a simple example of the grammatical pattern, but you can't really use it. So you want simple and useful at the bottom of all of that. And again, the reason why I'm talking about this mostly for grammar is because there are lots and lots of effective ways to prioritize vocabulary. I hinted at some of it, but it's usually grammar that people get stuck on, because grammar is the usage and the patterns that go beneath, you know, that run beneath the sort of everyday consciousness of speakers and also learners. So if there's anything that linguists can really contribute, it's having a very clear consciousness of that, and then hopefully going through this set of processes to make sure that awareness of how grammar works can actually translate into a way that's a learnable way of getting at those patterns learning to use those patterns, where learnable mostly is the intersection of useful enough that I'll keep on that I'll have reasons to use it and I'll immediately see why I'd want to use it, and also foundational and minimal. Anyone else? You have 2 minutes.
I think we're out of time.
Okay.
So
we're out of time officially, but you're welcome to ask Connor questions after we sort of shut down officially. We have to make room in the time schedule for the next for the master classes at 4:00. So just thank you, Connor, very much for the presentation. And thank you, everybody, for coming.